Welcome to the Taylor Report. I'm going to make sure we say that. CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon.
Hello, Phil.
I'm good.
Today on the program, we are going to talk to our friend the Mountain, Thomas C. Mountain, and after the Mountain, we're going to find out what's left. We're going to speak to Stephen Gowans. Stephen Gowans at What's Left. Stephen Gowans. We'll be first of all talking with Thomas Mountain about the situation in Eritrea. Along the way, we're going to talk about some of these. There's a lot of news here of a morbid type. Vaclav Havel died, and there's a lot of articles about him. It's Kim Il-sung, right?
Kim Jong-il, the son of Kim Il-sung.
Kim
Jong-il.
Kim
Il-sung was his father.
That's how bright I am. And, of course, Christopher Hitchens.
And Caesarea Evora.
Who?
Caesarea Evora, the greatest barroom singer in the world, right, from the Cap Verde Islands.
See, I come here to learn these things. I did not know that. Yeah. Actually, well, no, later we're going to have to ask you to explain yourself.
Yeah.
So we'll be going into these matters. We of course like to focus a lot in our program on Africa and East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and we talked to Thomas Mountain previous about these things. He is in a part of the world where there's a lot of combat, and the great powers are busy trying to create problems, and there's been a resolution sponsored by the U.S. To bring more sanctions against Eritrea, and I believe that's the principal thing on Thomas's mind that we will want to get at. We ought to say something, Phil, about hockey news. There's an excellent article I saw in Yahoo News. A doctor who's an authority on the brain asking the NHL to just play hockey and stop trying to be a fighting sport. You know, it's a business model. Should you allow this? Should you encourage it or not? I'm happy that he gets into the speculation about do you need that, because he says when you say, oh, people want to see it, there's a lot of people who don't. And if you did, so if you change your model, you might find out you track different people. We have a number of all-star players who are down and out. Yeah. And some of them, by the way, look to me to be seriously at risk. I mentioned, for example, just an American in NFL football. There was a great quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys a few years ago. He got three or four concussions in over a short span. And then he retired. And they asked him why. And he said, the doctor told me I might not wake up from one of those. It is time to depart.
Well, and I think at this point the scientific evidence is really mounting. Recently there was a very young hockey player who died, and when his brain was examined by specialists in this area, they said that he had an advanced disease that grows out of this kind of trauma. And it's not uncommon. And now you have like the best player in the game, Crosby, right? Who knows if he's even going to be able to finish his career because of a gratuitous hit. You know.
And how many of those can you take? Actually, the answer is you don't know.
Yeah.
And so that's...
The safe level is zero.
Pardon me?
The safe level is zero. You shouldn't take any of those hits. You know?
I think we're joined now by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes.
Hey, thank you very much for being with us. You're visiting London. You just spoke at a conference. It's at the it's called the Pan Horn Conference, I believe.
Pan Horn of Africa Conference.
Yes. And you were the keynote speaker. So we better ask you, what did you have to say? What was the main matter in your mind that you had to bring to that conference?
Well, we were addressing the main crimes being committed by mainly the U.S. but also the United Nations in the Horn of Africa. We started with the Fuday blockade, which is really a genocide against the people of the Ogaden, which is located in southeast Ethiopia, where the Ethiopian government, which is funded by the West, is instituted a Fuday blockade to several million people who, according to the United Nations Famine Early Warning System, are starving. Mm-hmm. And they've kicked the Red Cross and the Doctors Without Borders out of there for 4 years now, and the world is silent. Is everybody saying, oh, Somalia, yes, there's problems in Somalia, but they're actually not mainly job-related. But in the Ogaden, because there's an armed insurgency against the Ethiopian government, they've just basically put a scorched earth and a genocidal policy just to try to starve the people out. That was the first thing we addressed, and then the second question, of course, is this whole scandal of the so-called famine relief in Somalia, how the UN sent the Ethiopians in 2006 to destroy the peace movement in Mogadishu, led by the Union of Islamic Courts, and created about 500,000 Somali refugees in the Ethiopian invasion. When the Ethiopians were driven out by the Somali resistance, they brought the African Union so-called peacekeepers from Burundi and Uganda into Mogadishu, who have now managed to flatten about 30 square miles of Mogadishu with their helicopter gunships and artillery and tanks, and created another 500,000 refugees. So we had this summer about 1 million refugees created by the United States and the UN, in camps funded by the UN, and then the UN announces that because of so-called funding shortfalls, they're going to cut the minimum food rations to these refugees by 70%. So they're going to institute a genocidal slow starvation policy against the Somali refugees, which they created in the first place.
Yeah. And under the rubric of helping them.
That's right. So at the time, I predicted crocodile tears from the international aid agencies, which certainly we had this Anthony Lake, the failed CIA nominee, the director of CIA, has now head of UNICEF out there on TV saying, oh, we need hundreds of millions of dollars to feed the starving refugees created by the famine. No, they were created by the UN and the U.S. Hmm. And, of course, there has been a record-breaking drought, a 60-year-long worst drought in the region, but the most of the refugees weren't from the drought. And then, on the other hand, they say, oh, the resistance led by the al-Shabaab fighters is blocking international agencies from providing food aid to the refugees. Well, that's a lie. And finally, one newspaper managed to call the Red Cross, and they said, no, we're not being blocked by the al-Shabaab from providing food aid. But they're still repeating that lie. Just the other day in The Independent, Daniel Howden's writing about, al-Shabaab is blocking international agencies from providing food aid. What? The food aid cuts are being instituted by the international community, not by the al-Shabaab. So that's the second crime. And then, of course, we just had the United Nations pass what ended up being merely symbolic sanctions, quote-unquote, against Eritrea for supporting al-Shabaab. Well, you know, we've known from WikiLeaks that way back in 2007, the senior U.S. diplomat in the Horn of Africa, U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia, Donald Yamamoto, was secretly writing to his bosses in Washington, D.C., that the Eritrean involvement in Somalia was insignificant, as in very small or trivial. All the while, we've been hearing from the United Nations Monitoring Group on Eritrea and Somalia, Eritrea is supporting al-Shabaab, Eritrea is supporting al-Shabaab, publicly. Mm-hmm. So they use this as a basis to say, the United Nations in Security Council should pass sanctions against Eritrea's emerging mining industry and to block the Eritrean people outside from sending their 2% tax home to their country, which basically has been one of the main survival mainstays through some very difficult times for the Eritrean government. Well, Eritrea now has the fastest growing economy in Africa. Much of Africa's starving economy is contracting, if not collapsing. And what is the UN and Security Council going to do? Pass sanctions against the fastest growing economy in Africa? Why? For this allegedly supporting terrorism in Somalia? When we know that in their own senior ambassadors that is that no such thing is happening. Yeah. So, you know, this is another long series of crimes that are being committed in the name of humanitarianism or the war on terror, which is really the war on the Somali people. And we say all roads to peace in the Horn of Africa run through Eritrea, through Asmara, Eritrea. All these peace movements trying to bring peace and build some sort of cooperation and stability in the Horn of Africa take place in Asmara. So what does the United States do? Pass sanctions. Well, it turns out that Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., couldn't convince anyone that these Eritrea really is supporting terrorism. Even the Europeans blocked the attempt to cripple the mining industry and sending money home to their country. And the sanctions passed were basically all bark and no bite. They just were recommendations that the mining industry, for example, which is right now is only the Canadian-owned mining company, Nevsun Resources, basically harassed the Eritrean government, demanded that Eritrean government not prove that they're not supporting terrorism in any case. How can you prove something you're not doing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they also said that, you know, all the countries that where Eritreans live that are sending money home to their government should harass the Eritreans as much as possible. So the first round of sanctions, this is the second round of supposed sanctions against Eritrea. The first was passed the day before Christmas in a closed-door session at the United Nations, and actually included a provision blocking arms sales to Eritrea. Now, Eritrea was invaded by Ethiopia in 2000. Huge war, 150,000 dead, 1.5 million refugees. Ethiopia, which has the largest best-equipped army in Africa, has still got about 500,000 troops, not only on the Eritrea's border, but continues to occupy sovereign Eritrean territory in violation of a final and binding border demarcation and peace treaty Ethiopia signed. So, anyway, Ethiopian troops regularly come across the border in incursions into Eritrea. So, Eritrea has to maintain a military and defend itself against Ethiopia. So, the United Nations puts an arms embargo on Eritrea. This is violating Eritrea's right to self-defense, which is a violation of the very UN Charter. So, you know, this is the three things I addressed. I've also talked about the situation in Sudan, how the you know, there's big problems in South Sudan now, and there's just reports coming out now that basically through corruption, Western and other countries are coming to South Sudan, and they're basically buying up big chunks of land for various uses, which, you know, I mean, there's not even established land ownership, and they're supposedly buying this land. Who are they buying it from?
People that live there, not selling it. Yeah. I want to tell people this is Thomas Mountain. By the way, I read in countercurrents.org, the piece where you referred to this matter of, we discussed at some length the matter of the Ogaden situation, and I just want our listeners to know that. But, Thomas, I got to ask you, who is it that's buying up this land in South Sudan? Who is that?
All kinds of people. There are people from agricultural people, the people that supposedly create ecotourism. They're, you know, I just saw the report, and it's a bit alarming, but, you know, it's sort of the Wild West in South Sudan now. The thing is, see, the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, which is the military wing of the Sudanese People's Liberation Movement, which is basically the government in South Sudan, salary is being paid for the last 2 years by the United States.
They're paying the salaries of the South Sudan Sudanese government?
Well, the Sudanese people, the military in South Sudan, salaries, $100 million a year of salaries is being paid by the United States. And yet this military is actually fighting itself. There's been mutinies in all the different ethnically based wings of the military. There's big outbreaks of fighting between the different ethnic groups, which are whose salaries are supposedly being paid by the United States. So since there's this problem of all this violence, on the, especially around the border regions in South Sudan and
it's an invitation,
South Sudan and North.
An invitation to a type of civil war, right? If there's going to be what you might call spoils, who is going to get that those salaries? The temptation to knock each other off would be rather great.
Well, the thing is, now the United States has pressured the Sudanese to allow peacekeepers to come in. Well, who are the peacekeepers? They're from Ethiopia. They're bringing, they're going to be something like eventually 10,000 Ethiopian peacekeepers along the border between North and South Sudan, which is where all the oil is.
Yeah.
So, and who's paying for the stop? The Ethiopian peacekeepers? The United States.
Yeah. No, that is...
So, you know, the U.S. is basically the party that this really pushed through the dismemberment of Sudan. They didn't want a strong, united, independent Sudan. So there's a very strong belief that the South Sudanese leader, John Garang, was assassinated by the U.S. via a helicopter crash.
Well, it's awfully convenient. That, he disappears at the most important moment. I mean, who could not assume that he was.
Well, and the thing is, it's really ironic that the leader of the Sudanese people, the father of South Sudanese independence, was actually adamantly opposed to South Sudanese independence. John Garang said, no, we want a one strong, independent, united Sudan. He never wanted, he is against independence. And so today they have a memorial to John Garang in South Sudan, independent South Sudan, and yet John Garang is against independence.
Yeah. It's like a curse. By the way, Thomas, now, and again, this is Thomas Mountain, and he's in London. He spoke at a conference there. I guess I'm curious, too, the area you are visiting from, the Horn of Africa, as you point out, the reporting is hardly accurate or up to date. Were people surprised at some of the issues you were addressing or some of the facts that came out there? What did they say about the sort of environment for information in England?
Well, the people I was addressing were people from the region.
Mm-hmm.
So the crowd was exclusively Horn of Africans, people from the Ogaden, people from Oromia, Amhara, people from Eritrea, people from Somalia. And the reason they invited me to address the conference is because I guess I'm the only journalist from the region that's been consistently telling the truth about what's going on. So they asked me to come and talk and give the people an update, but also serve as a chance to bring the Horn of African community together, which is kind of a new phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, historically, the organizations have been sort of fighting their own battles, and the need to begin to, you know, see common ground and see this region as something that the people need to really unite more. It's, you know, the people I agree with, it's just sort of getting the leadership to put the pieces together that, you know, bring it all together. So I was sort of a catalyst in that sense to bring everybody together, and I'm just hoping they keep the momentum up and keep building this. They've invited me to speak in the United States, and if you guys are in Toronto, I know there's a lot of Horn of Africans in Toronto.
Indeed. We ought to bring you here.
Yeah, well, I'm seriously looking at coming to Washington, D.C. and up in Minneapolis and this summer, so if any of you Horn of Africans are out there, you know, you might want to contact your local activists from the region and see if they can arrange something, because I'd be more than willing to come to Toronto.
Oh, let's do that. We are going to hold you to that. We are on the same continent with Washington, and so we would be really glad to see you. But this is Thomas Mountain. And Thomas, I got to ask you about this U.S. Pushing the sanctions point. But you say they don't get a big a warm reception for this in the General Assembly or whatnot, but they still manage to muscle these things, don't they?
Well, you know, it's, I tell you how lack of principles. This whole UN Insecurity Council voted 13-0 in favor of these so-called sanctions, with Russia and China abstaining. And South Africa voted in favor of the sanctions. Now, in 2009, the UN General Assembly appointed the South African ambassador, then Dumisani Khumalo, to head a special committee to investigate the situation in Somalia. And they did a very credible investigation. They issued a report, and the report exonerated Eritrea, and it said that all the arms in Somalia were there from either the Ethiopians, from the United States, shipping arms in, or were sold on the black market by the African Union peacekeepers, whose salaries basically been embezzled by their officers. Mm-hmm. So here's South Africa's own ambassador headed a report that cleared Eritrea, and the South African ambassador, 2 years later, is voting to condemn Eritrea for supporting terrorism. So, I mean, the developing world once again has shown that they're completely without principles. They're basically kowtowing to the United States.
It's a scary
situation. And that's what they did.
Of course, we relate this to the Libya matter. South Africa voted for the no-fly, right?
If the South African ambassador had not voted for the no-fly zone in the Libyan resolution, it would not have had a majority of the Security Council, and it would not have passed.
Mm-hmm.
So once again, the South Africans want to say, oh, this is terrible, and then they vote for it.
Yeah. Now, it is, that's a very worrying trend. Now, I have to ask you, apropos of Libya, and of course we can see a crisis developing every day around Syria, with the drumbeat being, well, we have to do to Syria what we were kind enough to do to Libya. There's a theme that struck here that I want to know your thoughts about. The media love to say, well, we have reports, all sorts of wonderful people phone us up and tell us that the Syrian government is doing bad things, but they said, and so they report that without it checking. But then they say, you see, we have to go with these freelance people who are phoning us and telling us wild stories, like the lesbian from Libya and all that. Not Libya, pardon me, Syria. But then they say, but the problem is, you see, we don't have access. But if they had access, based on what they did when they had access in Libya, would you believe them?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've got access to the Horn of Africa, and all we get is, like I say, don't believe anything you read and almost nothing you see from the Horn of Africa. Just all fabrications. I mean, Syria, the difference between Syria and Libya is, one, Syria's got a strong, well-organized military. I think that it's pretty clear now that the popular demonstrations against the problems they've had with their government have been, they've died down, and now it's just like an external forces waging a war against Syria. I mean, they're coming across the border from Jordan and from Turkey and from Lebanon and attacking the Syrians, and they've killed over 1,000 police and military officers. So, but the thing is, Syria's got a pretty tough military, and their intelligence services are pretty nasty, too. So I don't see, they've got, the Russia has moved its aircraft carrier to Syria, their military base in Syria. So that's a very strong statement from the Russians to the West, that look, we're not going to just sit by and allow you to take Syria, and we'll lose our only military naval base in the Mediterranean. So, Russia's not going to allow any of that. And then, but I think the role of Turkey in all of this has become very exposed, because why is Turkey suddenly turning on Syria and hosting this armed intervention against Syria? I mean, Turkey's got its own war with the PKK, the Kurds.
Yes.
And then now they're turning around and saying, oh, as they fight the Kurds, they're saying, oh, Syria is suppressing their internal opposition. Well, they've got something like 2,000 Turkish Kurdish villages that were basically ethnically cleansed by the Turks in the last 20 years, and millions of Kurds have been driven off their ancestral land into internal exile, and then Turkey's going to turn around and say, oh, Syria is doing bad things to their people.
Mm-hmm.
Syria is another story altogether.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly, as you say, and we've been talking about that, by the way, in recent programs that we had last week. Zafar Bengash, Crescent International, does a lot of, he follows it very closely. He, like you, said that this is not Libya. And certainly, when, for example, we had a Canadian warship sailed up to the Libyan coast and performed its military duties, etc., they would probably not so comfortably try that with Syria. I suspect they'll stay in their ports.
Well, Libya, you know, Libya barely didn't have an army at all. I mean, they had all these, they've spent a fortune in all these weapons that the, for example, the fighters in Sirte had taken all these Scud missiles and driven them out into the orchards and parked them because they didn't know how to use them. So, I mean, this was basically a war between civilian populations because Libya didn't really have a military. I guess Gaddafi was scared about the historical role of the military in Africa as being used to overthrow governments by the West. So they didn't really have a military, and it was basically a civilian population fighting against a civilian population, whereas in Syria they've got a pretty hardened, well-led military. And, you know, and the thing is that Syria government is basically a Shia government. And the majority of Syria is Sunni, and they're trying to provoke a Sunni uprising against the Shia-led government of Syria. But in any case, Syria is...
And the media, Western media is helping out with that. The New York Times and the Globe and Mail and others love to talk about the Alawis as though they're big authorities on them. And clearly, they're trying to incite something, which it would not be very pretty if they got their wish.
Well, you know, there's a Shia, what's called the Shia Belt, and it runs from northern Yemen across the eastern Saudi Arabia, which all the Saudi oil is located. Well, Saudi oil fields are in the Shia Belt, and the Shia in Saudi now are becoming restive because started with what the Shia uprising in Bahrain. So if the Shia, you know, really take up arms against the Saudi government in the eastern oil fields, then Saudi's going to be in trouble. And then it stretches into Kuwait, the Shia Belt, and then into Iraq, and then into Syria and into Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're all very sympathetic to Iran and supported by Iran. So a lot of this attacks on Syria is really a kind of a proxy war against Iranian influence in the region, I suspect.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking. This is Thomas Mountain, and just Google Thomas Mountain Eritrea, and you will get a lot of excellent articles by Thomas. And I guess in closing here, Thomas, I want to ask you again. Now, you spoke of Eritrea, despite all the challenges and the sanctions, et cetera, remains a growing economy, and you also spoke of their ability to defend themselves. How do you project that over the next period of time? Do you think they're going to be able to sustain this?
Well, Eritrea is projected to have the fastest, double-digit growth in its economy for the next 5 years at least. So our first gold mine has been up and running for a year now. That gold mine is about to begin, it's beginning production in the copper extraction, and that will double the output profit-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Our second gold mine is scheduled to start construction this year, 2012. And then we've got an enormous potash or fertilizer development down in the south where they're talking about maybe 150 years and tens of billions of dollars of potash being extracted for fertilizer in conjunction with the Indians. And so Eritrea is looking like
it's got a
very long period of growth ahead of us. The rest of the Horn of Africa has been suffering drought and famine, and yet in Eritrea our markets are stuffed full of grain. Grain prices have fallen by half in the last year, so we've been what we call an island of food in Africa's Horn of Hunger. So if you're successful in our region, they want to punish you.
Yeah.
If you're like Ethiopia and you've got millions starving and they turn around and hand out $5, $6, $7 billion of aid every year. So,
yeah.
You know, Eritrea is actually, I think the hard times have passed and things are starting to look much better for our country. I think that's why the United States is so desperate to see it snatched away from us.
I suspect you're right. This is, we've been talking to Thomas C. Mountain. And Thomas, we're going to hold you to that promise to come up here. When is you due to be in Washington?
Well, we're looking at, sometime this early summer, but we're still looking at, I'm trying to put together, my wife's got to come up for some medical tests, and so we're trying to schedule a doctor's appointment, and then around that, the trip, so I'll let you know.
Do that, and we will tell our listeners, and I know a lot of people here would love to see you, so thank you very, very much for being with us.
Okay, Toronto, ciao.
Okay. Thomas T. Mount, thank you. This is a Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. You can check us out. That's Thomas hanging up. And then it's at Taylor-Report.com if you want to catch us on the net. And you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and we're going to find out what's left with Stephen Gowans. And we're back, Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be waiting. Shortly, we're going to be talking to Stephen Gowans, but I've got to ask Phil Conlon. You have some union news
in
Toronto.
There's a strike going on in York Region. York Region contracts it out. This is your classic neoliberal. We'll take public transit out of the hands of the public and hand it to for-profit companies. And the Amalgamated Transit Union has to deal with the fact that these for-profit companies basically have to line their own pockets with the wages of the drivers. So they have been on strike in the town of Markham, town of Richmond Hill for about 6 weeks now. The community is not served by any kind of public transit at all now for about 6 weeks, and no interest from anybody in the government or anybody important to deal with the issue. And so the union has been stepping up its pressure tactics and picketing, having demonstrations in the city of York. Now, today, the city of York said they're going to go and try to get a judge to get injunctions against the union. So that's a good story. We're going to keep an eye on it. They have a website, the atucanada.ca, is the Amalgamated Transit Union, and I urge people to inform themselves about this strike. That's getting very hot.
Okay. Maybe next week we'll have something to say about that. We might talk to some of them. I think we're joined now by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am, Phil. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Nice to talk to you. This is stephengowans.wordpress.com. Or is it Gowans? Maybe I say it's not
Gowans.wordpress.com.
Yeah, Gowans.wordpress.com. And, Stephen, let's start with this the news of the demise of a one of the leaders of one of the, what I guess now they're calling the Color Revolution. I think he was called the Velvet Revolution. This was Václav Havel. You have an item about Václav Havel, less admiring than those I can read in the Globe. Who was this guy?
Yeah, Václav Havel. It's not mentioned often. He was kind of the scion of a very prominent, very wealthy, very anti-socialist Prague family, which had extensive holdings in construction companies, real estate, film studios.
I seem to recall didn't they have a monopoly on the film business?
Yeah, I mean, he came from a very prominent, very wealthy family. He had servants. He had a chauffeured around. He had, governesses. And one of the things that he wrote is, it's really funny, is that he said, you know, he was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, but this was a cross that he had to bear.
he has that in common with Hitchens, I think.
he actually wrote, he said, you know, I was different from my schoolmates whose families did not have domestics or nurses or chauffeurs, but I experienced these differences as a disadvantage because he felt excluded from the company of his peers. But the interesting thing about him is that he restored these disadvantages as soon as he became president of...
He was nostalgic about their disadvantages.
That's right, because once he became president, he made sure that he restored all of his family's holdings to himself and his brother. Mm-hmm. So it was quite a good investment. I mean, his anti-socialism and anti-communism turned out to be a profitable investment for him. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, you might recall Otto Jelinek, who was a cabinet minister in the Mulroney government, mm-hmm. in the 80s. He was a Czech who came also from a fairly wealthy Czech family. I mean, they fled to Canada after the Red Army booted the Nazis out. Mm-hmm. And he returned to the Czech Republic after the communists were driven from power. And like Havel, he too had his family's property restored to him. So I think he had his family owned a large estate outside of Prague, which Jelinek now enjoys the advantages of.
Yeah, I guess there are good checks and bad checks. You probably know Rick Razos, Stop NATO site. He has an article he reprinted today from the 1999 Ottawa Citizen celebrating the coming to Canada of Vaclav Havel, and the title of the article was Bombs Combat Evil, and it was Havel's commitment to NATO's bombing of Kosovo. And the Globe was explaining to its readers how a human rights advocate and humanitarian like Havel would be so enthusiastic. Can you talk about that a little bit, his support, how he kind of won favor amongst the NATO gang?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's celebrated as the great champion of human rights and dignity and freedoms. And yet, if you look at his record, I mean, what he did was he ensured that the Czech Republic joined NATO. He certainly joined up with a whole lot of militarily aggressive and imperialist countries. And, you know, one of the things I find that is really interesting about the way in which he's portrayed in the press is they talk in very abstract terms about what he was a champion of. He was a champion of freedom, of human rights. And yet, he was a champion of these things,
mm-hmm.
And he replaced the communist government, which, of course, is reviled, but when you look at what it was the communist government delivered, what the communist government delivered wasn't, you know, these abstractions that Havel is associated with, but very concrete things that appeal to ordinary people, like full employment and free health care and free education. And I think that it was a former East German who said, you know, they talk about Havel as being the great champion of freedoms. Well, what freedoms are we talking about? We're talking about freedoms from full employment, freedom from free health care, freedom from education, freedom from free streets, freedom from Social Security. And some people in the Czech Republic today talk about, well, you know, you can complain about the communist era. This is a time when we had to line up for bananas, queue for bananas, but now we're queuing in the unemployment line. So which would you rather do?
And yes, there are no bananas in that line. We're talking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. And that's it, by the way, Stephen, maybe a good segue to ask you this. We just had an election in Russia, and there's big, great hue and cry, and Hillary Clinton is quite worried about whether or not the elections all went according to Hoyle, something she didn't do when her own party lost in Florida, but I guess that's, I have to explain that's another way, another day. But about Russia, I don't see a lot of writers pointing out that that the second most powerful party to Mr. Putin is the Communist Party.
Uh-huh.
Is that right?
Yes.
I mean, they talk about, oh, maybe the election didn't go well, and they think it would have went well if maybe a billionaire who now owns the New Jersey Nets would have won, but he wasn't going to, the people he's supporting didn't finish second.
No, and the communists have maintained in Russia, I mean, a fairly sizable degree of support, especially among older people who kind of remember what life used to be like.
Social Security, full employment, medicine, yes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. but, I mean, we're not being served very well, are we, by the media that doesn't point this out? I mean, there is obvious, when you give people a chance to express themselves, they are there is a strong base, and this is true throughout East Europe, of people who would actually prefer the old system. I mean, that is becoming evident. They do say, well, there's a nostalgia for totalitarianism, but they don't mention that maybe actually is a nostalgia for a way of life that was preferable.
Yeah, there's an enormous nostalgia. In fact, and you can see this in a number of, first in newspaper reporting, if you read some of it very closely, you'll see articles in which reporters interview people who lived in the communist times who wax nostalgic about the way life was and talk about how bad it is today compared to what it was like. And then there are also systematic polls that have been done that showed that there was a considerable, remains a considerable amount of support for that way of life. In fact, just before getting on the phone with you, I was looking at a poll that had been done in Hungary, which found that it was 60% said that life under communist rule was the happiest time, and only 13% said that life in the post-communist era has been happy. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of representative of what you see in other post-communist societies.
Mm-hmm. Again, we're speaking to Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. Stephen, we had another, we just last past 48 hours, the death of the leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-il. And we're hearing, the way they're playing the story here is they say, well, the South Korea has gone on full military alert, as though there's a threat, some kind of problem with the North. But what sort of leader do they have in the South? And is he one who's bent on peaceful resolutions of problems in the world?
No, absolutely not. He's a very aggressive, and his policies have been, and this isn't just me talking, I mean, this is kind of established foreign policy or establishment foreign policy analysts in the United States saying that the goal of the current leader of South Korea is the absorption of North Korea into South Korea, the collapse of North Korea. And it's kind of interesting the way in which the death of Kim Jong-il has been portrayed. I mean, North Korea is a military pipsqueak, and it's facing off against South Korea, which has a much larger military budget, much more sophisticated military than North Korea does. And it's also facing off against the United States and Japan. I mean, this is a very small, or military pipsqueak, as I say, against military gargantua. So you have to ask yourself, why is it, as some people in the press have been alleging, that the North Korean leadership would want to, mm-hmm. fight with these military gargantua? It certainly wouldn't be in the interest of North Korea. But if you consider that one of the goals of South Korea and a goal of the United States is to see the collapse of North Korea.
Yes, by the way, they used to about 5 or 10 years ago, they were practically ready to announce it on a daily basis. So it's all over, and who's going to buy this and who's going to buy that?
Right, and then, I mean, so you have the death of the leader, you have now a succession. Things become uncertain. I mean, this is the perfect time to do something against North Korea if you're the South or if the United mm-hmm. States. So
there's where the threat would be, is someone trying to exploit this opportunity from the South.
Yeah, exactly. So why do they put their military on high alert? I mean, mm-hmm. we put our military on high alert. That sends a message. That's simply escalating military tension, threatening North Korea. And, I mean, that's the objective, is not only to threaten North Korea, but to starve North Koreans into submission. We heard a lot about, you know, Kim Jong-il was acquiring nuclear weapons while starving his people. Well, no one ever mentions that North Korea is the most heavily sanctioned country in the world. This was something that George W. Bush reminded us of. And the intention of, well, in fact, North Korea has been subjected to effectively an economic blockade, or the kinds of sanctions regime that Iraq had been subjected to. So you would expect hunger to be prevalent in North mm-hmm. Korea. You would expect their medical system to have collapsed. And the intention is to make them collapse. It's kind of amusing now to hear talk about, or various humanitarian groups saying, well, the North Koreans need some kind of food aid, and the United States saying, well, I don't know if we can provide any food aid, you know, because, well, this might go to the army. But, I mean, the United States would no more provide food aid now to North Korea than the Entente, you know, would have provided food aid to Germany when mm-hmm. they mounted an economic blockade in the First World War with the intention of starving the Germans into submission. So there's this intention with sanctions to starve the North Koreans into submission, also with military pressure, you know, like continually keeping the North Koreans on alert to force the North Koreans to allocate a crippling percentage of their limited resources into their military. Yeah. I mean, this complaint had always been made about Kim Jong-il, about he invested all of his resources in the military. The army came first. Well, there was a reason for that, and that is that the country was under continual military pressure and threat.
Yeah, and by the way, Stephen, shouldn't we also point out that you have a totally unnatural situation in the South in that they are an occupied country. The United States came there in 1945 and never went home.
Yeah.
And there really isn't. I mean, we've had some tests of this, and you recall there was some really large activities, huge student demonstrations and whatnot. Many patriotic Koreans want one Korea, and they don't want to be occupied by a Western power.
Mm-hmm. Someone once pointed out that when South Korean soldiers look across the border, they see Koreans. When North Korean soldiers look across the border, they see Koreans and they see Americans. Mm. And they also know that the person who runs the South Korean military is an American. I mean, the South Korean military is subordinate to the U.S. military. And it will remain so for a number of years. There was supposed to be a handoff of responsibility that was going to occur.
And it's very important to remind everyone of that, because any student of the Korean War and all these things knows that the old claim was, the Koreans are subordinate to Moscow, they're subordinate to China, and they're occupied. But there are no Russian troops in North Korea, and there are no Chinese troops.
That's right. There were, you know, at the time, many years ago, for a short period, there were some Soviet troops. And then during immediately after the Korean War, there were Chinese troops, you're right, but they left. And there haven't been foreign troops on North Korean soil for decades. But the American presence continues in South Korea. Mm-hmm. And as I said, the American military runs the South Korean military. It's answerable to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, as you said, it's an occupied country.
It's an anomaly that we have to. They continually talk about, the type of leadership in the North and how they're fragile. But I remember that Jimmy Carter said, "I don't understand why we have so many troops in South Korea. I think we ought to reduce them." And there was talk about they ought to remove him from office.
And I think Jimmy Carter also said that any of the conflict or the tension on the Korean Peninsula could be resolved in a single afternoon if anyone wanted to. Certainly the North Koreans would like that to happen, but the United States isn't particularly interested. There was a U.S. State Department official who said the reason why we'll never have any kind of treaty or agreement with North Korea is because they have nothing to offer us. There's nothing to offer because they have a closed economy, so they're not going to allow us to establish bases on their territory. They wouldn't allow us, they're not going to open their doors to U.S. foreign investment on U.S. terms or U.S. exports on U.S. terms, so why should we do a deal with them? Our objective is simply to make them collapse.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's, by the way, why your site, and this is gowans.wordpress.com, really details this, the assumptions people make about why we have these issues with other states. And you point out much of it has to do with states who resist U.S. trade monopoly, right? I mean, U.S., they call it free trade, but they mean monopoly. If you deal with them, you got to do it their way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, free trade, free markets, free enterprise. And you do it their way, but I mean, the United States being a highly developed economy, If you open your doors, if you're North Korea, which isn't a highly developed economy, and you open your doors to the United States with free trade agreements and you allow free U.S. free enterprise in your soil, I mean, you're essentially saying, here, absorb us, we'll become an appendage of your economy. So it certainly isn't to the advantage of North Korea or any developing country to enter into that kind of relationship, in the same way that the United States, you know, in the 19th century wasn't going to enter into that kind of relationship with Britain, then the dominant economic power. And the United States at that time had the highest tariffs in the world.
Yeah.
And it was only because it had high tariffs and insisted upon, you know, a self-directed economic development that it was able to become a rich.
Actually, they had to go to war about that. Actually, they were told you cannot go to any port anywhere in Europe without first going to London.
Right. Yeah.
And at that time, they were, of course, a different type of people, ideologically speaking. This is Stephen Gowans. I better ask you this. Americans are, as we read today, pumping their fists and blowing whistles and saying, that's it, we're out of, the war is over in Iraq. Well, I always thought that was kind of what they used to call an expeditionary operation, but has the U.S. withdrawn from Iraq? How would you characterize what they've done there?
Well, yeah, they still have an enormous presence in Iraq and will, with an immense embassy, which I read occupies the equivalent of the space currently occupied in Washington by the White House and the adjoining Ellipse, or actually it's twice that size. So if you've ever been there, you know that that's quite a large area. And then the U.S. State Department will hire essentially mercenaries, contractors, so there'll be a large kind of mercenary organization. So the United States still has this enormous presence in Iraq, and there's also an intention to build up U.S. forces in the area,
mm-hmm.
Which can be deployed to Iraq quickly.
Yes, I would assume, you know, given the fact that the target number one in the region is the Islamic Republic, that this would be easily converted into a front if they needed it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I mean, they're not withdrawing militarily from the region, and they make no secret about that. They're quite open.
I assume they fly where they want in that neighborhood.
Yes.
They have a yes fly zone.
Yes.
Well, anyhow, Stephen, we're very grateful. We're sure glad to talk to you. Gowans.wordpress.com, and it's been very informative. I hope we talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Okay, okay. Bye-bye. That is Stephen Gowans, and a great website, What's Left, which is a good title. And speaking of what's left, we're left with some reflection here, Phil, about Christopher Hitchens' demise. To me, I really recommend, let's do it this way. Counterpunch has published an editorial position over the weekend. I call it a position, just a comment by Alexander Coburn. And I notice it's getting a lot of attention. Many people are going to that site because there's been a number of people who ought to know better writing, you know, oh, we miss him. He was such a marvelous guy. He was a contrarian in all this, you know. I'm afraid we can't all go through the same door. We can't have from the smaller or whatever he is at the National Post a front page article about the marvelous Christopher Hitchens, and then at the same time Robert Scheer, formerly at the Los Angeles Times and sort of a radical sort in California, saying a toast to Comrade Christopher. Somebody's mistaken. And I notice all the letters are running this way. The letter writers were all saying, oh, come on. I mean, the real question with him is, what was he? Was he a turncoat? Alexander Coburn's position is well stated. You know, they worked together at The Nation magazine, and they'd known each other for quite a long time. And So he's, in answering this thing of when did Hitchens become a bad fellow, he says he tried to put, and he, one of the details is some people claim that it was when he tried to put his close friend Blumenthal behind bars for imputed perjury. People forget that Christopher Hitchens provided an affidavit to the Republican Party to make their case against, to get Mr. Blumenthal arrested. And Christopher Hitchens was exploiting a personal relationship. He had, over dinner, Blumenthal had, he claimed, told him something that that should, would it put, if told in public, put Mr. Blumenthal in danger of having, they claimed, they were going to claim he had lied to a grand jury. And so Coburn says, well, some people say that was the moment. And he said, my answer was that Christopher had been pretty much the same package since the beginning, always allowing for the ravages of entropy as the years passed. He said, I never thought of him at all as at all radical. He craved to be an insider. And pointing out that he was sworn in as a U.S. citizen by Bush's Director of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff. He had he was an instinctive flag wagger and remained so. He wrote some really awful stuff in the early 90s about how indigenous peoples, Indians in the Americas, were inevitably going to be rolled over by the wheels of progress and should not be mourned. Kind of important stuff. So this is a Coburn's take on him. And there's been another piece written, which if you, and I, it's on a site that I highly recommend, called The Angry Arab. I know people go to The Angry Arab, but there's the University of California, Stanislaus, State University. And he has his name is Khalil, Professor Khalil. We're going to try to get him on a program sometime, but he calls himself The Angry Arab because he's an honest Lebanese who tells the truth as he sees it. And he said he was leaving a television show one day and noticed that someone had written under his name to describe the program, said Angry Arab. He said, okay, that's me from now on. Anyway, if you go to his site today, and just write Angry Arab, you'll find it. He has it's available by clicking on it, an article by Norman Finkelstein, who is a very, very courageous university professor in the United States, and people known certainly to our listeners. So you'll get Norman Finkelstein's explanation of who Christopher Hitchens was. And one of the things that he points out is he said Hitchens once, of course, notorious, famously attacked Henry Kissinger. And Kissinger, he should be remembered, was once thought of as a progressive too. And that at the end of the article, Christopher Hitchens says of Kissinger, he's a corpulent opportunist. And then Norman Finkelstein says, sounds familiar. I suggest those you go to make that point. And also the Angry Arab's own analysis is, he said if he hadn't gone to the right, there wouldn't be a lot of space devoted to him if he had remained on the left, which is also Finkelstein's point, because Finkelstein says that he thought that Christopher was always looking for a chance to turn his coat and make more money and be more famous. And remember, too, that he once debated George Galloway. And if you did not know that, Galloway beat him rather wonderfully. And that isn't being noted. But Galloway said of him, he said, Hitchens is one of those rare cases of reverse evolution. He went from being a butterfly to a worm. And he said, usually it goes the other way. Anyway, we have to wrap up. This is Phil Taylor for Phil Conlon and for Carol. And I want to thank everybody. And write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. Check us out, taylor-report.com. And this is CIUT 89.5 FM. We'll see you next week.